James Reynolds with you on OM.
Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. In case you haven't heard, the first presidential debate takes place tomorrow. And by the time we get to October, it's going to be hard to get through your day, let alone a football game, without hearing about politics. Especially the hyper-partisan political messaging that shows up at the end of every close campaign. But what if you're not a fire-in-the-belly, flame-throwing kind of partisan? What if you actually see both sides of an issue, if you like straddling the middle? Does that neutrality come at a cost? Joseph Sieve is a postdoctoral fellow in consumer behavior at the University of Virginia. His research examines how political attitudes and identities shape both social life and culture. Welcome to All Sides, Joseph.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
I have to say, this new research is, it particularly hit hard as a journalist who always tries to appear as though she is sitting in the middle. But maybe it explains why political opinion of journalists is so very low these days.
Yes, that's a great connection. I think that's part of the dynamics that we're touching on in our research, for sure.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, just to give folks a really quick background on what we did in this study. So this was actually research that I conducted as a grad student at Ohio State in collaboration with other Ohio State alums. That's Aviva Philip Muller and Jeff Durso and a psychology professor at OSU, Dwayne Wegner. And as you said, you know, a lot of people hold nuanced opinions on political issues. And yet at the same time, political discourse seems so polarized. And so we were interested in whether kind of everyday social dynamics might be contributing to that by incentivizing expressing these one-sided opinions, but disincentivizing expressing more nuanced ones. And so we focused on ambivalence, which, like you said, is seeing both sides. And we found that people who endorse aspects of both sides of an issue often pay a social price in terms of being a bit less popular than people who are expressing more polarized opinions. And so that could help explain potentially why we see that moderate opinions are underrepresented and that political discourse seems so extreme.
Yeah, because you would think that someone who can hold that kind of nuance, it might be a sign that they've really thought about the issue, investigated the issue. It could be something that, like I can see the logic in why you might respect somebody with a more nuanced position, but it turns out that we just see them as less likable.
On average, that is the case, yeah. And, you know, you alluded to people expecting this to go over well, right? In our study, we actually found that people find it intuitive that if they agree with aspects of both sides of an argument, that they'll be able to get along reasonably well with people across the political spectrum. And so it feels kind of like a safe strategy, but we found that kind of ironically, people's expectations were too optimistic. It turned out that, you know, expressing these opinions were it was risky, and people often paid a price for it. And so there's this mismatch between what seems intuitive, that if I'm nuanced and thoughtful, that people will respond well to it, but it doesn't, at least often, play out quite that way.
And when it comes to how we feel about people with strong partisan opinions, what was so fascinating to me is, obviously, we like the people who have strong opinions that agree with us. But right. We also seem to like the people who have strong opinions that we disagree with more than those folks in the middle.
Well, so there are some nuances here to bring nuance, not to get too meta about it, but there's some nuances there where it depends on what the person who is making this judgment's views are also. Mm. And so what we found is that the people who are really skeptical of both sidesism or of ambivalent opinions are people who are on the same side of the issue. So it's kind of political in-group members. So for example, you could think about debates among Democrats between the more progressive wing and the more centrist wing of the Democratic Party. You'll have criticism coming from the more left side of that toward the middle about both sidesism or about being insufficiently committed. And so that's really where this dislike or unpopularity is coming from. But on the other side of the aisle, so when you think about expressing ambivalence to try to connect with people who you are on the opposing side from, that's not seeming to be very helpful. You might think that it would be, but it seems like people are kind of thinking, well, if you're wrong, you're wrong, because that's the nature of polarization, is this kind of zero-sumness or black and white type of perspective. And so there's this asymmetry in the end where people on their own side are paying a price for expressing nuanced opinions, and then on the other side, trying to
They're
relate
not
to
winning any
people.
points.
Exactly.
You
That's
know,
exactly it.
it makes me think of a sports analogy. I wonder, so, you know, sports teams will battle it out with each other fiercely. But at the end of the day, there is this professional respect, right? You brought your hardest and your best, and either you won or you lost. But I have respect for you, for the talent, for the skill, for the things that you brought, right? You see this a lot amongst football quarterbacks, right? Joe Burrows and
Yeah.
Patrick Mahomes have a lot of respect for each other, even though they'd like to pummel each other on the field. And I wonder if that's how partisans see it. Like, I have respect for the other guy, even if I want to crush him.
There could be something to that. The sports analogy is an interesting one because there are so many ways in which politics parallels that, especially in a two-party system where we have this kind of head-to-head structure. We have this extra element of morality and identities that are really fundamental to how people see themselves in politics. Although, people take sports very seriously too. So there can be that kind of mutual respect across disagreement, although we're starting from a pretty low baseline because unfortunately the parties see each other pretty negatively in this day and age. So even though they're not seeing ambivalent people as more negative on the other side, there still unfortunately is a lot of animosity there to begin with. So that's part of what we're contending with here.
You know, the other piece of your research that I found particularly interesting comes with whether to get into these conversations in the first place, like whether we should even engage in political arguments. So, can you talk a little bit about what you were studying there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so what we think is going on here is that there are reasons for people who have nuanced positions to avoid these discussions because they experience this backlash when they express nuance. They feel this lack of popularity or this dislike or skepticism that they're getting from some people. And so people opt out. People opt out of politics and political discussions all the time. There's very important research on this. For example, a book called The Other Divide by a political scientist named Krupnikov and Ryan. And they show that a really fundamental divide in our society is between people who are engaged with politics and people who really would rather stay out of it. Part of the issue, though, is that it's not always so easy to stay out of it because you find yourself in situations where people will infer your beliefs, will ask you your beliefs. And in those situations, there can actually be a cost to declining to share your positions. And so there's a bit of a catch-22 at times where you have to choose between either staying out of it and avoiding a fight or kind of dissembling and withholding your position and then having people wonder about why you're doing that. And that's some research on neutrality, staying out of it, and the cost of that by Ike Silver and Alex Shaw, some very interesting research that came out a couple of years ago too. So it's a dilemma that people are facing here.
Yeah, there's a price to pay for not sharing your opinion, essentially.
Exactly, and potentially a price to pay for sharing it, or at least for sharing one that people disagree with on some level.
I wonder if this distrust of people who seem ambivalent translates if it's conditional upon issue, right? So immigration, abortion, there's so many very you're either with me or against me issues, but I wonder for some issues that perhaps don't have that moral component to it, if ambivalence is a little more tolerated.
I think that's very possible. So you said that, issues vary on how moral they are. So that could be one aspect of it. So maybe issues that people are less morally convicted about, ambivalence could go over better. It could also just be that issues where more people are ambivalent, a higher percentage of people have some ambivalence, that could also mean that ambivalent people would kind of be more popular and fare better because they're aligned with more people. So there are going to be some issues where that's the case. And also, by the same token, there are going to be some social contexts and some groups where ambivalence will be better received and that'll be more hospitable to that kind of nuance. And so I think both the topic and the group or the social context matter a lot. So there's going to be nuances here, and the message is not that ambivalence is always going to be badly received. I think it's more that there's a risk involved, and it's worth being thoughtful about the issue that we're engaging on and the people that we're engaging with on that issue.
Do you think, I kind of wonder about turnout in this conversation, right? Because 30 to 40% of Americans, like give or take, right, just don't vote in our major national elections. And don't even get me started on special elections or off-year elections or all
Right.
these different iterations. I
Yes.
wonder if some of this is those people, I don't know, in the middle, the people who are like, I'm just not going to bother with any of this. Because it's crazy to me to think that we could be talking on one hand about how important this election is, but we also know that millions of Americans are going to stay home and just not vote.
That's right. And one thing that we know about ambivalence from a lot of research in political science and psychology and in other areas of research as well is that it tends to reduce participation. So ambivalent people on average are less likely to turn out to vote. So what can we do to try to encourage them to do so, especially in an election that a lot of us consider to be really important? I mean, at a general level, the truthful answer is that people need better options, I think. If ambivalence is reducing political participation, and as I just said, that's usually what it does, then we need to give people parties and candidates that they feel less ambivalent about. Obviously, that's easier said than done. So another aspect of it is, I think, to try to come up with ways to make political discourse more hospitable for ambivalence and for nuance. That's also easier said than done, but I do think that any individual who has a stake in making political discourse constructive and nuanced can play a role here, because one part of this dynamic is that people with moderate opinions don't tend to boost and support each other as much as people who are aligned with each other on the polls. So people who have polarized opinions have a lot of in-group kind of positivity and will amplify their messages and be loyal to one another in a way that people who are moderate tend not to do. And so we get this kind of group cohesion on the polls, on the left and the right, whereas it's almost like it's every moderate for themselves. And so if we want to encourage nuance, then I think one thing that we can do is to boost nuanced messages and people who we think are making constructive contributions to the discourse. There is an opportunity for each of us individually to try to contribute to that.
Maybe we should all take a lesson from our mother when somebody offers a nuanced political opinion, which is if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all.
That's right. Hear, hear.
Yeah, because I think part of it is then if you are partisan, if you have very strong opinions and somebody makes a case for the other side or says why they understand it, maybe it is best to swallow that thought if you want more polite political discourse.
Yes. And also, to encourage people when they make constructive contributions. So yes, being circumspect about it and not jumping into every fight when someone is wrong on the internet, right? That's kind of a meme these days. Someone is wrong on the internet and I can't restrain myself from jumping into the fray. So yeah, probably holding back from that and also, engaging when it actually is good and constructive.
I'm gonna like clip that and send it to anybody ever in our Facebook comments.
Yes,
Now,
I will retweet it or repost it on whatever platform you
social
post that on.
media, I think, in a lot of ways has contributed to this because it's so much easier to be obnoxious from behind your keyboard.
Yes, it is. Yep. Anonymity and just the psychological distance plays a role there also.
So, final question, outside of maybe, thinking before we all speak, is there anything else that you think we can do to tamper down the tone of our political discourse?
It's such a hard question, and I think there are a lot of components to it. One aspect that we haven't touched on yet, some of the things that we've already talked about, I think, are part of the answer there. But one thing that we haven't talked about yet, is something that's captured in this other study that came out recently, which is about how people perceive political polarization and political debates. And what it shows is that people are actually a bit too pessimistic about what's going on there. This is an article by Erica Bailey and colleagues. And what they show is that people think that there's tons of contentious debates going on between people who disagree with each other and are really angry. And that makes people feel bad about the state of politics, and it makes them less interested in participating in political discussions. It turns out that there's a lot less of that happening than people tend to think. So there are various reasons for that. Part of it is social media algorithms that boost extreme content. But understanding that things actually aren't quite as bad as they can sometimes seem because of social media and because of the way that information just gets passed through our media ecosystem, that can help people feel a little bit better. And it can also create an opportunity to carve out conversations with people that are going to be constructive, especially with people that we have non-political connections with. So it could be friends and family, or it could be someone that you develop a personal rapport with, and then that creates a more trusting context for having those political discussions. So understanding that things aren't necessarily as bad as they can seem, and then using that as a prompt to engage constructively is, I think, a way to think about it.
Yeah, actually, one of the things, and I will, take a little bit of the blame for this, is that as a former legislative reporter, that most of the bills that come out of our state house are bipartisan, and that's true for a lot of state legislatures. The majority of what they pass are things that both sides agree on. But the bills that get the most attention, the bills that get the most coverage, are the super controversial ones where people have super big feelings, where there's these really emotional testimonies. The boring bill where everybody agrees that this is just a really great idea tend not to bubble up.
That's right. Yeah, conflict sells. Extremity, negativity, these things sells. But yeah, there's a lot of cooperation that's going on. It does not get the attention that we would ideally like it to get. So let's try to amplify the good in our political discourse.
I feel like that was a little bit of a call out, but I will take it under good advice.
I would not intend it that way.
No, it's good. That was Joseph Se Sieve, sorry, a postdoctoral fellow in consumer behavior at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, soaking up the summer sun can put us in contact with a whole different set of germs at the pool, on the trail, even in our backyards. We're talking how to stay safe this summer when All Sides with Anna Staver returns on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Summer is officially here, which means it's time for barbecuing, swimming, and hiking in the mountains. And while these outdoor activities can be a great way to spend a summer day, they also bring a whole new host of germs and bacteria that we're exposed to. Here to tell us how to stay safe this summer is Bill Sullivan, professor of microbiology and toxicology at Indiana University. Welcome to All Sides, Bill.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
We're officially in the summer season. We're actually in the mid-90s a lot already here in Ohio. But with the season, that means we're doing a lot of outdoor activities. And one of the most common outdoor activities is the backyard barbecue. And barbecues mean lots of different concerns, including that question that sometimes we always ask, which is, how long has this been sitting out here in the hot sun? I think that's one of the ways people sometimes get food poisoning at barbecues. Is that correct? They just they eat that dicey coleslaw and it just doesn't go well.
Food poisoning is certainly the biggest concern and spike of infections that we usually see during this time of year, mostly related to, as you said, food sitting out too long, which provides an opportunity for potentially infectious bacteria to grow. In addition, a lot of people are fans of raw or perhaps undercooked meats, and that's playing a little bit of Russian roulette with some of the pathogens that may be on or inside that meat. There's also a rise in the consumption of seafood this time of year, particularly shellfish. And if you enjoy raw shellfish, you should be aware that there could be food poisoning bacteria, as well as parasitic oocysts that could be present in these filter feeders of the ocean. And another potential danger that people don't recognize in their very own backyard, it's rather underappreciated, are germs that could be in their garden. Now, we certainly don't want to deter people from gardening. Growing fruits and vegetables is certainly very healthy. But there's a parasite called Toxoplasma gondii that is spread by cats. And if your garden happens to be used as a bathroom for a cat, your fruits and vegetables could be contaminated with parasite oocysts. So be sure to wash those to avoid Toxoplasma infection.
Oh, that's a really good point because it depends on whether you have an outdoor cat, whether your neighbor has an outdoor cat. That so if you find animal droppings in your vegetable garden, that's a sign to be a little extra careful.
Absolutely. And another common place we see that is in the sandbox. Cats like to use the sandbox as a litter box. So if you have young ones who might be playing in your sandbox, be vigilant for that as well. You certainly don't want to have them come down with an infection by this parasite.
Another thing that can happen to your outdoor vegetables is birds can leave their own presence on your fruits and vegetables. And one of the things that I have learned is that you cannot eat that raw at that point, particularly if it's kale or lettuce or something with a lot of little wrinkles.
That's right, because that can make it a little more difficult to wash out. And just another really good reason why you should wash those fruits and vegetables, particularly here in the Midwest, you can see outbreaks of a fungus called histoplasma. And that is usually left behind by bird droppings.
Yeah, we unfortunately have had a bird that keeps pooping on our kale, and I'm like, oh, that's the end of that. It's unfortunate, but it happens. I also want to talk about water because when the weather gets hot, we like to go to the swimming pool, we like to go to lakes, we like to go to the beach. And there is that one bacteria that we hear about a lot. That warm, fresh water contains the brain-eating amoeba. And I know everybody kind of freaks out about it, but then everybody kind of forgets about it.
Yes, that's a good point. And I want to emphasize right up front that it's a disproportionate fear because the brain-eating amoeba, while it is really disturbing and it certainly can infect people, it's very rare. It certainly isn't something that comes to the front of my mind when I'm thinking about dangers in the water. But since we're on the subject, it is caused by a parasite, a single-celled amoeba called Nigleria. And it usually sits at the bottom of freshwater lakes and ponds. And when people enter these waters and stir up that sediment, this amoeba can be inhaled through the nose. So if you snort up an appreciable amount of this contaminated water, the amoeba can migrate to the brain. And unfortunately, just like the name, it starts eating away at brain tissue. It is serious because it is almost always fatal. There's no good treatments for it. And people, unfortunately, usually will succumb to that infection within 7 days. Again,
Very
disturbing,
rare.
sinister, but rare. You can wear nose plugs if you want to safeguard yourself. The amoeba certainly is more predominant in warmer bodies of water. So if the water feels a little warm, maybe put the nose plugs on and give yourself that extra peace of mind. What I get a little more concerned about this time of year are the public pools. You know, the public pools and the splash pads and the fountains,
But there's
those are great.
chlorine in the public pool.
Yes, there is. And that is a really good sign that you're in high quality facilities. But there are germs out there that can survive in chlorine just long enough to get from one person to another. And these are things like norovirus, the bacteria E. coli, and parasites like Cryptosporidium and Giardia. Swallowing any of those germs can give you a stomach illness that'll result in cramping and diarrhea, which can lead to dangerous dehydration. So even though there's chlorinated water, do your best to try not and swallow it, and maybe take a shower immediately after using those facilities just to be on the safe side. And do everyone a solid. if you happen to be infected with one of these stomach germs, don't go back in the public water for about 2 weeks after your symptoms disappear.
I saw a sign about that at the public pool just the other day. It said if you'd had diarrhea, don't come in for at least 2 weeks. I didn't realize that it was that long that you should stay out of the pool.
Most people don't, because as soon as symptoms disappear, you think you're fine and good to go. But just to be on the safe side, physicians like to advise people, give it at least 1 week, preferably two, just so you don't accidentally infect someone else.
I also want to talk about if you have an open wound, a brand new piercing, or have just gotten a tattoo. Because if you're going to be in an open body of water, like the ocean or a lake, you need to cover it up.
That's right. And I would emphasize that this is even more urgent now, because there was a new study done just last year that has linked flesh-eating bacteria to climate change. So as the ocean temperatures are increasing, we're seeing more and more cases of flesh-eating bacteria caused by a bacteria called Vibrio vulnificus. And this is present usually in ocean or brackish water, as you said, and it gets into the body through an open wound of some kind, a fresh scrape, a fresh cut, even a new piercing or tattoo. So cover those up with a waterproof bandage to prevent this bacteria from getting into your body, because if it does, it produces necrotizing fasciitis, flesh-eating disease. That's not something you want. It's as bad as it sounds. And it usually is very difficult to treat and results in surgical removal of the infected tissue, sometimes even amputation of the limb.
Yeah, that sounds super not fun.
Super not fun. That'll put a damper on your summer activities for sure.
I want to circle back real quick to the amoeba that eats your brain, because you said warming waters is making it more likely to get this flesh-eating bacteria. Is warming waters also making it more likely that we could accidentally inhale one of these amoebas?
You're right about that. So yeah, this is another gift that climate change keeps giving us. The amoeba that we referred to that causes the brain-eating disease has been found as far north as Wisconsin because of the warmer waters. In the decades past, it was pretty restricted to the southern United States, but that doesn't appear to be the case any longer.
Well, that's fun.
Not so much fun, but good to be vigilant about. Again, if you're in the warm water, just slap on some nose plugs and give yourself that extra peace of mind.
Speaking of things brought on by a warmer climate, the Center for Disease Control issued a warning just yesterday about dengue fever. And I was like, I thought that's a tropical disease. Why are we getting warnings about it here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. The CDC just issued that alert yesterday, and it even took me by surprise. There have been about 10 million cases of dengue fever in countries in the Americas just this year, and the year's not over yet. This is twice the number that we've ever seen in previous years. So it's a record-breaking phenomenon that is unfolding right before our eyes. Dengue fever is almost unheard of in the United States, even in our southern territories like Puerto Rico, but they've been seeing an alarming number of cases this year because of climate change creating warmer winters, which allow mosquitoes to thrive. And mosquitoes are the vector that transmits this particular virus, among many others. Climate change is also producing more hospitable places further north where these mosquitoes can thrive. So unfortunately, as you said, we are seeing tropical and subtropical diseases creep their way further north as warmer temperatures take over the globe.
And it's also summer is the time for vacation. So if you're going to a tropical beach, you could be bringing it home without even knowing it.
Exactly. And that's where most cases in the U.S. Have been reported from, travelers. But now we're seeing cases within our own borders in the southern states and Florida as well, some parts of Texas. Another creepy crawly that's making its way up into our country is the kissing bug. And that's of concern, because it carries a parasite called Trypanosome cruzii, which causes a disease called Chagas disease. And this ultimately can inflame the heart and give people cardiomyopathies. It's quite dangerous, usually restricted to South America and Central America. Now we're seeing cases of this parasite in the southern US because of the migration of the kissing bug.
What is a kissing bug? I don't think I've ever heard of one.
Oh, brace yourself.
Oh, no.
This is a wonderful insect that likes to feed on your blood while you sleep, and it bites you on the face.
Oh.
Thus the name, right? So the bite is irritating, and while the kissing bug takes its blood meal, it's not a very glamorous thing, but it usually defecates right on your skin as it's eating. And you can't see this, but you can feel the bite, and you will scratch at it. And when you do that, you are rubbing that bug's contaminated feces right into your bloodstream, into your wound, and that's how the parasite gains access to the bloodstream.
Okay, that's a new fear that you've just unlocked.
Yeah,
Oh,
sorry about that, but
my goodness. I.
on the plus side, there are some antiparasitics that people can take. The problem is, in the United States, a lot of physicians aren't aware that this has crossed our border, and they need to be more vigilant and put this on their radar as a possibility when they see people come into the ER hospital.
Oh, my goodness. So if I have a weird welt on my face, don't scratch it.
Yeah, don't be tempted to scratch it.
Finally, I want to talk about hiking and camping because these are two great summer activities that I personally enjoy with my family. And I will admit to having broken one of your rules. I have drank from a stream. Now, it was a rushing stream, not a stagnant body of water, and I was miles away from my car and out of water on a very hot day. So I saw it as a calculated risk, but it definitely is a risk.
It definitely is. And by no means are we trying to deter people from hiking or camping or doing any of the fun activities we talked about. We're just trying to help people to do them safely because it's much more fun to keep doing them than rather, be in the bathroom all the time or locked up in the hospital getting over something. But yes, when you're out on the hiking trail, you might be tempted. You might even see some water that looks super clean. But unless you've got a microscope with you, there's really no way to tell whether it has an infectious bacteria or a parasite like Cryptosporidium or Giardia. Again, if you don't boil the water properly or filter it robustly, you could become infected with any of these stomach germs, come down with a very severe case of gastrointestinal distress and diarrhea that could lead to dehydration. Definitely something you don't want when you're out there without access to indoor plumbing or aloe-infused toilet paper.
Yeah, so I was fine. It was a rushing stream. I was like, I know it's still a risk, but a stagnant body of water, especially like a shallow stagnant pool, that is like just no matter how thirsty you are, pass over that water.
Right. When the water is still like that, the bugs have an opportunity to thrive. When you're drinking from a more rigorously moving stream, they're usually being washed along with it. Your chances go down, but you got lucky,
I did.
and I'm glad that you did. But yes, it is a little bit of a gamble, even if the water is moving like that.
Yeah, one time when I was hiking, we were looking at the stream thinking, oh, that might be a good place to fill up with water if we needed it. And then we got a little further up and there was a dead ram. And so
Oh
you
boy.
sometimes you just don't know what's upstream. Like we didn't know until we saw it, and that can actually impact the water even though it's rushing.
Yep, absolutely. Good case in point. So if you do boil the water, you pretty much negate any possibility of getting any of those infectious diseases.
And they do have those water tabs, right? They can make the water taste pretty nasty, but you can put them in the water theoretically to clean them
Yeah, and
if
trust
you're in a
me.
desperate situation.
Compromising with some bad tasting water is much better than coming down with one of these intestinal parasites or bugs while out on the hiking trail.
Oh, yeah. So are there any other things that we should be worried about when hiking or camping?
Yes, again, I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but thanks to the warm winters brought on by climate change, we're seeing an explosion in tick and mosquito populations. So, ticks are carriers of a number of bacteria that can cause Lyme disease or things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And mosquitoes carry all sorts of viruses. We've already mentioned dengue fever, but they also carry more common ones like West Nile and Zika virus, which pregnant women need to be especially careful of because it's been associated with causing birth defects. So to avoid tick and mosquito bites, the number one thing doctors tell people is to wear insect repellent. Okay, don't sleep outdoors. Go inside a tent or get some kind of mosquito net to prevent them from biting you. Try to cover up as much skin as possible and wear light-colored clothing so you can spot those little buggers a little more easily. And then finally, be sure to inspect yourself for ticks, including like your armpits and scalp, if you've been outside, and pull them off promptly and carefully. If you develop any sort of symptoms from an insect bite, even 2 or 3 weeks later, go get checked out by a medical professional just to be on the safe side.
And check your pets, your dogs in particular, they can pick up all kinds of ticks.
Very good point. Use those flea collars that are supposed to deter ticks, but don't rely on them completely. Do a manual check. That is a very intelligent, safe thing to do.
They also like to live in weird, like warm places. You can find them like behind your ears, underneath your armpits, like in all these little crevices in your body.
Yeah, you got to check thoroughly, especially in those hard to reach places.
That was Bill Sullivan, professor of microbiology and toxicology at Indiana University. Thank you for joining me and for scaring the crap out of all of our listeners.
I'm very sorry to put a damper on summer fun, but I am hopeful that we are actually going to allow people to enjoy the great outdoors much more so than they normally would.
Coming up, pickleball is America's fastest growing sport. Which means it's also growing in injuries. More on how to stay safe when on the court when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We recently devoted an hour to the increasing popularity of pickleball. It's actually America's fastest growing sport, with participation rates now rivaling golf, basketball, even tennis. But with increased participation in any sport comes an increase in sports-related injuries. Joining me now to share tips for staying safe on the pickleball court is Dr. Ben Bring, a family and sports medicine physician with Ohio Health. Welcome back to All Sides, Ben.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Anna.
So, what kinds of injuries do you see from people playing pickleball?
Yeah, so pickleball, with any sport, there's going to be a risk of injury. Some of the most common things that we'll see will be lower extremity injuries. Things like ankle sprains or Achilles injuries. What's interesting though is with pickleball is even with the lateral movements and things in the lower extremities, we can also get upper extremity injuries. And even with falls and things like that, we can get broken bones in the wrists and hands, as well as commonly rotator cuff injuries in the shoulder as well. But the one thing that I've seen though is the cardiovascular, the heart benefits, and the social interaction benefits from pickleball, I think are vastly more important than the potential risk for injury. But yes, absolutely, we've seen quite an uptick nationally in those pickleball injuries.
What's interesting about that is pickleball, in a lot of ways, is sold as a lower impact, a less intensive sports activity that people of all ages can enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, and yet, as with anything, I mean, you could fall walking and break your leg.
Correct. Yes. Right. And exactly. So whenever I have patients that come to me and ask about my recommendations, pickleball is one of the best sports, especially for patients over the age of 50, that you can get interactive with. And I always cite there's a couple of studies that just came out that showed improved longevity anywhere between 6 to 10 years for those that play any type of racket sport. And to your point, you know, it's almost as popular as tennis now. And tennis is a little bit more, is a little bit harder because you have to cover so much more ground. But with pickleball, you know, you don't have to do as much of the running back and forth, but you still get that added benefit of longevity, even with pickleball and playing those sports. And so it's absolutely one of the things that I recommend to our patients for sure.
So what should we do to stay safer on the pickleball court? I assume warming up always helps, no matter what you're playing.
Love a great warm-up routine. And one thing that I think that often gets overlooked is weightlifting. And this is a lot of things that I recommend for a lot of our older patients as well. Things that get overlooked is as you get past, you know, kind of like that age 35 to 40, a lot of us will start to lose muscle mass, unfortunately, as we get older. And I think that, you know, we're kind of at a crossroads where we also see benefits in longevity for patients who have improved and increased muscle mass. It can definitely prevent falls. It can definitely prevent injuries. And especially in the pickleball realm, there's a lot of lateral movement back and forth. And we don't use a lot of these muscles. I call them the hip stabilizers, things like the gluteus medius, the piriformis. Those are that are within the hip are oftentimes very, very weak in many of us. And so a good strength training program can really help mitigate some of those injury risks, especially in the lower extremity. And then looking at the upper extremity, when we talked about some of the upper back and rotator cuff injuries, this is really we're having strong shoulders, especially what we call the scapular stabilizers, the muscles that kind of attach to the scapula, kind of that chicken wing bone in the back. Those can really help prevent rotator cuff injuries as well.
So, what are some of the exercises a person can do to strengthen those balancing muscles? Because I actually think as you age, that can be critically important no matter what you're doing.
For sure. You know, I always refer back to some of those old infomercials in the 90s growing up where you do a lot of the planks, the side planks, you know, the Jane Fondas and the Richard Simmons videos. For those that are too young to remember those, but you know, a lot of those are really good hip activators. So whenever we look at hip extension, that's where like gluteal bridges can be very helpful. Planks and side planks can be really good for some of that strengthening as well. And any kind of lateral hip work that you can do can be very helpful. I also like if you're capable of squats and lunges. Now I know some patients with some knee arthritis, it may be difficult to get into some of those deep squat, deep lunge positions. But if you're still able to do those can be very beneficial. And one of my favorite things to recommend is actually walking backwards. Now we spend so much time going forwards, we often lose our ability to go side to side laterally and then backwards as well. And a lot of the muscles, what we call in the posterior chain, things like your hamstrings and your gluteal muscles, we lose the ability to fire those appropriately, like to get them activated. And so those are really important muscles to look at to strengthen as well.
Oh, one of the things I love to do on the treadmill as a is turn it down to like usually 1.5 miles an hour. You have to go pretty slow and then try to walk sideways.
Love it. Yeah. And exactly what you're doing is you're strengthening those lateral hip stabilizers. And even and if you can add in a little bit of an incline while walking backwards, if you're capable of doing that, that can really give you a little bit more of not only the cardiovascular benefit, but also some of that anaerobic strength training there as well.
You'll be amazed at how slow you have to go if you try to walk sideways or backwards.
It's wild. And you know, I played soccer and football, you know, in my younger days. And now before I go for runs, or if I do anything active, I really have to spend time doing these warm-up routines. And the reason is because, you know, as a physician, I spend a lot of the day sitting, unfortunately, and a lot of these muscles get turned off. And so basically what you have to do is try to activate them the best that you can prior to activity, especially with strength training. And back to your original point of a really good warm-up routine, that's really why, you know, when before even any strength training or any physical activity, finding really good warm-up exercises can be really beneficial.
So when it comes to those shoulder muscles, because a rotator cuff tear is no joke,
Shoulders hurt.
how do we protect our shoulders there?
So I'm a big fan of resistance bands and resistance training. And so as we get older too, you know, our tendons, unfortunately, and our shoulders and hips become a lot less pliable. The blood supply is not as good. And so tendons in our body, they're meant to be loaded with weight. And unfortunately, as we get older, we kind of overlook resistance training. I think they're, that's something that I would recommend anyone listening, get in touch with their friendly neighborhood physical therapist or physician and look at a really good strength training regimen, especially for the rotator cuff. Some of those muscles that attach to the scapula are super important, things that get overlooked, the serratus anterior. This is what I call the punching muscle. If you look at some of the boxers that have really developed serratus anterior muscles, that can really help with shoulder stability. And then obviously all of the rotator cuff muscles, anything with internal and external rotation and resistance band training can be very, very beneficial. And as we get older too, unfortunately, we start to develop what's called shoulder impingement, where some of those structures can get pinched. And so for some of our older patients, I'll recommend avoiding heavy overhead lifting and try to do a lot of that strength training with your elbows at your sides.
If you have a rotator cuff injury, should you be playing pickleball, even if it's because there's a lot of that like swinging motion with your arm?
Right. So, the rotator cuff, it's made up of four tendons: the subscapularis, the supraspinatus, the infraspinatus, and teres minor. These tendons, a lot of times we will find incidental tears on patients all the time. So I'm trained in musculoskeletal ultrasound. But what I've found over the years is if we can get patients into a really good strength training program, we can actually help mitigate some of the pain from some of those injuries. Another common injury I'll see in these tendons are what's called tendinosis or tendinopathy. And this is just kind of over the years where the tendon gets beat up. It doesn't really necessarily have tears or inflammation, but it can get a little bit thickened and can cause some other risk factors there. So honestly, doing more motion and movement and getting into a good strength training program prior to playing pickleball, I always tell patients I try to find ways to keep them active and to always keep them playing the sports that they love. So very rarely will I tell a runner to stop running or a pickleball player to stop playing pickleball.
Yeah, it can be hard, especially if you do have certain injuries that can be made worse by the thing that you love doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is why, we're very lucky nowadays. We have a lot of different treatment modalities and things that we can help treat some of these tendon injuries. Or if there are signs of shoulder impingement, which are some of the more common injuries that we'll see in pickleball, of really working on that posterior shoulder stability. One thing that I always love to do when you go to the gym, you almost see everybody doing push exercises. Everyone loves the beach muscles, doing the bench press, the incline, and dumbbells. What we often forget about are the pulling muscles. So the lat pull downs, the rows, bent over rows, seated rows, those can really help create a very, very strong shoulder and give you a lot more stability in that region as well.
And a rowing machine is a fantastic cardiovascular workout.
Love the rowing machines, right? I know. So my father-in-law has a rowing machine in the basement and he'll go down there for hours. And one of my former residents, who's now an attending out in Granville, Dr. Gallagher, she always says, "What has two thumbs and great rhomboids?" And she was a big rower, and that was always her. Shout out to Dr. Gallagher out in Granville.
Love that. So, to bring it back, when it comes to pickleball, like there's getting sore after playing for a couple hours, and then there's being injured. And sometimes I think with a rotator cuff tear, you're going to know pretty quickly what you've done. But with other injuries, sometimes you don't quite recognize, like, oh, I've actually really messed this up.
Right, and this is where getting, if you're new to the game of pickleball, I would really recommend working with, either a strength coach or somebody that can help you start to train prior to playing, what we would call prehab or like pre-rehabilitation prior to getting into the sport. And prevention is going to be very, very important here, especially with some of those lower extremity injury risks. Any way we can help mitigate those risks by improving your strength, improving your mobility and your balance, all of those things can definitely play a role in injury prevention. And you're definitely going to experience some soreness, especially in pickleball with that lateral movement. It's kind of like in Rocky III when he started swimming up and down the pool, and Apollo said, "You're going to start to, have soreness and use muscles you've never used before." And that's really what, a lot of new pickleball players will experience is some muscle soreness in some of those muscles that they haven't used in a while.
Any final tips for staying safe on the court or just staying safe while we're out being active this summer?
Yeah, I think, mobility is an often underutilized thing as well. So, unfortunately, many of us spend a lot of the day sitting kind of hunched over in that computer position. So if you can work on mobility, strength training, and then just that cardiovascular endurance, things like, getting your hips a lot more mobile, your ankles, even your big toe. One of my favorite exercises is to recommend great toe extension, by using a tennis ball or a golf ball. And that can really help with some of that ankle mobility as well. And, mobility can really help with prevention of those injuries as well. And that's probably my greatest advice for everyone. Get out there and try pickleball. It is a great sport. It's a growing sport. I know we've got a lot of really cool areas, new areas of pickleball here in Columbus. And like I said, great cardiovascular build up there, as well as, if you want to add 6 to 10 years to your life and reduce all-cause mortality, this is a great sport and one of the ones to pick up.
That was Dr. Ben Bring, family and sports medicine physician with Ohio Health. Thank you as always.
Thanks, Anna. Appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to 89.7 NPR News.